and welcome to Worlds Apart. The Middle East has always been a land of fast-shifting sands, but over the last couple of weeks, the geopolitical landscape of the region has changed so much that even the main stakeholders seem to have been caught unawares. Who's winning, who's losing, and for how long? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Craig Murray, a former British diplomat. Mr. Murray, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, I bet it's hard to surprise a seasoned diplomat, especially given the so many upheavals in the region over the last couple of years and the last couple of decades. But I think even by the current standards of unpredictability, the passing year has been pretty dramatic for the Middle Eastern region. What surprised, what struck you the most about the year 2024?
It's been spectacular and disastrous. And of course, the continual undercurrent we should never forget is the genocide which is ongoing in Gaza. And it's become so commonplace. We've become so accustomed to seeing images of dead children and destroyed hospitals and tortured doctors that, you know, there's a danger we lose sight of how remarkable that is and how terrible it is. But that has carried on steadily. I decided myself to go out. I wanted to try to get into Gaza. There's no way to do it. I applied for permission to get into the West Bank and couldn't get permission from Israelis who have to give you permission to pass through. So I went out to Lebanon a couple of months ago to cover the war in Lebanon. And then, of course, Syria erupted. So it's really a moving target in terms of what's happening across the Middle East at the moment. Really, much of the Middle East is ablaze.
Mm-hmm. Let me focus on the events in Syria for the time being, because the future of that state is pretty uncertain, with Israel and Turkey expanding their hold on Syria's territory, and many intelligence services across the entire region and perhaps around the world are trying to figure out where things are likely to move from here. And plus, there are also lots of atrocities happening there as well. What's your take? What's your intuition on how the future of this land, the future of this country is likely to evolve?
I think we are in for a prolonged period of war. We had the most extraordinary coalition of powers combine to put the current government into power in Syria. We had, obviously on the face of it, we had Turkey, the United States, and Israel, all of whom were very involved and have been involved long-term in promoting these particular jihadist Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Al-Nusra rebels. But then we have, of course, also the Gulf states, Qatar in particular, which have been funding them long-term as well. And we've seen this extraordinary coming together of apparently differing interests. The Turks want to be able to attack the Kurds in Syria and also to take territory in the north and take effective control of Aleppo, which they've done. The Americans are in conflict with the Turks over the Kurds because the Americans have been backing the Kurds, but the American primary aim is to maintain control of the oil fields of Syria in the north and east, which they have achieved. Israel has taken a great deal more land, but the land which Israel has occupied in Syria in the last couple of weeks is three times the size of the Gaza Strip, to put it into context. And the Gulf states have got what they wanted, which is a extreme Salafist Sunni government in Syria, which we will see become increasingly intolerant as the days go by.
But Mr. Murray, isn't that also what's paradoxical about this whole situation? They are all nominal allies, and they all have huge appetites, and yet each of them achieving something for itself puts them sort of on the loggerheads with their own allies, for example, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, or Turkey and the United States. Now, let's unpack it one by one. I want to start with the American and Western interests. And I somewhat surprisingly noticed that Western media for now have been rather restrained in their commentary, apart from perhaps trying to rebrand Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, a bony feeder jihadist group, as a sort of quasi civil organization. CNN ran a very formally looking interview with their leader, Abu Muhammad al-Julani, talking about the inclusion, building of institutions, and overall adopting this political Western language. What do you make of this rebranding? Do you think it's authentic? And what do you think it tries to achieve?
I think there's a certain authenticity to it, in that I think the Western powers have groomed a small number of leaders of a movement, al-Julani himself, of course, being the obvious one, who are willing to act as Western puppets in exchange for power, and who quite possibly is personally willing not to adopt the kind of extreme, violent Islamist terrorist agenda that he was following when he was with al-Qaeda and ISIS. It's perfectly possible that he himself, in exchange for power and wealth and all of those things, has dropped his ideology and is taking a different path. Whether the tens of thousands of jihadists, many of them Uyghurs and Uzbeks and Chechens and various Kazakhs and various other nationalities, who followed him into Damascus and who, you know, consisted of his fighting force, whether they are willing to drop the extreme Islamist agenda is a very different question indeed.
As far as Russia is concerned, I think this is a very pressing security challenge. According to some estimates, up to 30% of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham's fighters are professional jihadists. They come from Central Asia and, you know, they don't have any particular allegiance to political power transition in Syria. They are just there for hire. And plus, as we all know, there are also tens of thousands of former ISIS fighters held in jails under Kurdish control in eastern Syria. So if all of that force gets loose, I think al-Qaeda at some point may indeed seem like a moderate organization. And it's inexplicable to the Russians, at least. Is that kind of force not considered a threat in the West? Is there a belief that they can somehow be controlled or re-educated?
The Russians should understand it better than anybody, because, of course, this was the Western playbook during the Russian occupation of Afghanistan.
Absolutely, when the West... it backfired against the West bitterly with London bombings and 9/11 and all the other consequences. So, you know, it's hard for the Russians to believe that the Western memory is so short. There must be some sort of a plan.
Well, the West very seldom learns from history. And the United Kingdom, for example, has now invaded Afghanistan four times in history and has been defeated every time, but it doesn't stop them doing it from time to time. Learning from history is not a strong point of Western politicians. And this will boomerang, and undoubtedly it's going to lead to a revival of interest in extreme Islamic fanaticism, of Islamic terrorism. I think I'm pretty certain from, you know, speaking to my own diplomatic contacts, that the West's plan, certainly the British plan, which they will have been given by the Americans, is that the immediate idea will be to target these mercenaries and extreme jihadists on Iraq. To send them into Iraq to take on the Shia militia, and which broadly support the current Iraqi government, and that essentially they will look to repurpose them into restarting the Iraqi civil war in order to take further control of Iraq, that and to get them out of Syria, and my guess is liable to want to stick together as a fighting force, and unleashing them on Shia militia in Iraq would seem to me the way that the West will seek to dissipate their energies, if you like, and use them in a way which is still helpful to Western interests, because, of course, the Iraqi authorities have been trying without success to persuade the United States military to leave Iraq for some time. Chaos in Iraq helps the American military presence there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been following the situation in Gaza, and of course the collapse of the Syrian government has many implications for the conflict there, because Syria was used as the main logistical corridor for Hamas and other Palestinian factions. And I remember Hassan Nasrallah, the former Secretary General of Hezbollah, saying before he was assassinated by Israel that without Syria, there would be no Palestine. What do you think is likely to happen both to the Palestinian aspirations and the Palestinian hatred that is born out of those frustrated aspirations?
I think it must be said that the fall of Syria is a disaster for the axis of resistance, to use the commonly used terminology. The supply lines to Hezbollah are effectively cut off. And we shouldn't forget that the people who are now the government in Damascus are the absolute enemies of Hezbollah and have been fighting Hezbollah, and in fact had to be relocated by Israel. Israel was sheltering them in the shadow of the Golan Heights when they were defeated by Russia and Syria in the Syrian civil war, and they were, with Turkish agreement, relocated up north to Idlib. But Hezbollah paid a very large part in their defeat in the south. So they are sworn enemies of Hezbollah, and sworn enemies of Iran. So there's no way they're going to allow the continued supply of arms through Syria to Hezbollah from Iran. And it's worth noting that one of the very first major statements made by al-Jolani after he took power was to say that their enemies are Hezbollah and Iran, not Israel. So this is an Israel-friendly. This is effectively a Zionist government. I mean, so much of what's happening is crazy. And the notion of an ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Zionist government may sound strange. But on the other hand, people should ask themselves why it is that ISIS, Al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda never, ever once in their history attacked Israel or any Israeli interest. They've been sponsored by Israel all along from day one.
But Mr. Murray, I do repeat my question, though. What do you think that leaves the Palestinian aspirations of statehood and, all the harsh feelings associated with not being treated as human beings?
I think, sadly, the genocide in Gaza is at an advanced stage. Nobody really knows how many of the population have died, but there's no longer the infrastructure to support life viably in Gaza. And I think we will see the Israeli announcement of the annexation of Gaza really quite soon. In the West Bank, people live under Palestinian Authority, which I never thought I would see as somebody who used to support Fatah. I never thought I would see the Palestinian Authority become openly the tool of Israel, but that's what has become the case. But plainly, is no two-state solution. There cannot be a two-state solution. There's not enough left to form a Palestinian state. Gaza is demolished. The West Bank has seen the settlements, everyday settlements, expand in the West Bank. The amount of the West Bank under effective Palestinian control is a minority of the area and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And things like the water resources and agricultural land under Palestinian control shrink and shrink. And East Jerusalem similarly is increasingly occupied. So the idea of a two-state solution is dead.
Let's stop here on this very sobering note, but we will be back to the discussion in a few moments. But for now, we have to take a short break. Stay tuned.
In 1941, the radical right-wing Ustasha organization seized power and formed the independent state of Croatia.
Kroz pola Drine je bila mutna od krvi, a vam se osjećala bistrija Drina.
One of their main targets was children. Historical sources say the Ustasha killed over 72,000 children.
Iznese majka djetano bolo i nju zatrkoše se i upleća na benetom, ona pade djete tamo u cjelicu, golo pišti, a on dođeše i njega na nos.
Even the Germans themselves were horrified by the atrocities committed by the Ustasha.
Zločin nad decom je planirani zločin biološkog uništenja nacije, jer time se uništava ono što će poslije biti taj nacionalni korpus.
Pa ne znam da se može nazvati dete ubica čovjekom.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Craig Murray, a former British diplomat. Mr. Murray, before the break, we talked a lot about Israel, who for now seems to be the main beneficiary of what's happening in Syria. There have been some estimates that up to 80% of Syria's military infrastructure has been destroyed, and the Israeli tanks are now positioned within the 18 kilometers of the Syrian capital, and we all know what Israel takes, it rarely returns. Do you think it will stop there? Do you think it would go perhaps further? Because I've heard some Israeli officials now openly musing about Damascus being part of a supposedly great Israel. Where do you think it will stop?
Very hard to see where it will stop, because it's very hard to see what can stop them. The problem is nobody in the immediate region has any kind of air defenses against Israel. And while the Israeli army has proven to be pretty ineffective in ground combat in southern Lebanon, for example, its ability to just pound countries into submission from the air, supplied, of course, by the United States and Germany, is unchallenged, and that's what we saw in the Lebanon. It's not just in Syria. Israel plainly has no intention of leaving those parts of southern Lebanon it is occupying, and will almost certainly expand there further in the new year. I think people have to understand that the Greater Israel project is very real. It's not a concept, it's very real. And those of us who've been telling people about it, you know, are now seeing it realized in real time, with expansion into Gaza, into Syria, into Lebanon. And the world has to decide whether it's prepared to put up with this aggressive, colonialist, expansionist power, which has a fascist, racist doctrine, because that's what we face in the Middle East. It's very, very scary at the moment, because the Western world seems blind to the dangers of sponsoring such an extreme ideology.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Murray, let me play the devil's advocate for a moment, because I do agree with your characterizations of Israeli politics and policies, and yet the part of me, when I look at what's happening in the region and all the jihadist force moving around and the fears that many Christian and other minorities in the region have, then part of me sort of understands why some of them would appeal to Israel for some sort of a protectorate. Do you think it makes sense for Israel to try to be the guardian of those communities, if not on humanitarian, then on pure cynical geopolitical purposes?
It would be extraordinarily cynical, because I've been touring around southern Lebanon and visiting churches and schools and other institutions in Christian villages, which Israel has bombed and destroyed quite deliberately. In fact, Israel has wiped out many Christian communities in southern Lebanon. I visited one church Israel bombed, killing 15 ambulance workers who were using the church as a temporary headquarters during the emergency and who were killed there on a rest break. So, and in Gaza, of course, we have seen Israel destroy churches routinely and destroy hospitals run by Christian charities. So the idea that Israel has any sympathy for Christianity or is in any sense a possible sponsor of the Christian communities is nonsense. And I would say in Lebanon, I lived for 2 months inside one of the Christian communities in Lebanon, and only about 10 to 15% of the Christian minority in Lebanon would take the view that they support Israel. Now, among Christians in Lebanon, the vast majority of them detest Israel for what Israel is doing. There are, for historic reasons, there are pockets of, frankly, fascist Christian organizations which do support Israel, but they are in no sense a representative of a majority of the Christian population.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is another nominal American ally who is itching to expand its greatness in Syria, and I'm, of course, talking about Turkey, which whose officials are now openly discussing Aleppo being a part of their greater country. Do you think now is a good moment for the Turks to try to make their geopolitical fantasies a reality?
Most of us have been really taken aback by the open expansionism of the Turks and the extent to which Erdogan has come out of pretending, if you like, because he had done so much apparently good work in promoting the Palestinian cause, for example, whereas in the background all the time, he was plotting Turkish expansion into Syria. I don't imagine we will see any formal annexation of Syrian land by Turkey. But we will see, I think, continued Turkish military occupation and de facto control of Aleppo and a great deal more of the north by Turkey. I don't think they're going away anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. When I see all this competition for greater Israel or greater Turkey, part of me sort of is frozen because I think all the recent conflicts have taught great powers that they have to be extremely careful about, biting what they can chew. And I think that's one of the reasons you don't see the Russian army marching on Kyiv or Lviv, because it doesn't want to deal with that kind of a situation. This is one of the reasons why perhaps Iran and Russia pulled back and didn't stand to defend the Assad government. Do you think both Israel and Turkey have the resources, the military resources, the strategic resources, the soft power resources to not only occupy the land, but deal with the consequences of occupation and hopefully bring some sort of a settlement or lasting peace to those lands?
Turkey certainly has the military ability to do so. But of course, there's a great deal of resentment among Arab peoples at the idea of being ruled again by the Turks, who are in effect a former imperial power. They will certainly try to occupy as much of the Kurdish populated territory as they can. Israel will never bring peace. Israel is an ethno-supremacist or religio-supremacist state, which is, as many very respected organizations have pointed out, is founded on the principle of apartheid, and it only knows violence and aggression. The great worry is that what is collapsing is pluralism. Mm-hmm. So we are now seeing an extreme Salafist government installed in Damascus. We are seeing Israel dropping all pretense at attempting to live peacefully with the Palestinians and instead being intent upon their extermination and the establishment of a larger religious supremacist state. So the toleration and multi-ethnicity and multi-religious, multi-communal societies are greatly under threat in the Middle East. And as you alluded to earlier, the Christian communities, which are the oldest Christian communities in the world, which are where Christianity originated, they are the ones at greatest danger from the current developments.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think the irony of this whole situation is that there is also another third group of nominal American allies or Western allies like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, who are not very excited about seeing Syria being divided between Israel on one hand and Turkey and its Muslim Brotherhood proxies on the other hand. Do you think Washington or West more generally can still be an effective mediator among all its allies and their competing appetites?
It's always very difficult to understand the motivations of the Gulf states. On the one hand, you have the religious motivation in which they are very keen to see Sunni Islam and particularly Salafism and Wahhabism prevail, and that gives them a certain commonality of interest in this case with the Muslim Brotherhood types in Syria. On the other hand, those countries are all governed by ruling elites which are not really popular with their own public, and they are dependent upon United States military support and security service support and on Israeli security service support in order to stay in power against their own people. So there's this continual balance going on. And as ruling elites, their interest is in personal finance rather than any kind of global geostrategy. So you can't consider the Gulf states in terms of normal geopolitics, but they are very, very strange entities.
I only have time for one more question. My perception, at least, is that Russia, China, and a number of other countries are sort of pulling back and letting regional actors resolve this quibble, or perhaps letting the United States deal with all its competing allies. And I wonder if you think that's an exception, because we are quite used to the other way around, you know, great powers intervening, trying to, you know, expand their influence as Russia did, let's say, in 2012 and 2013 and later on. Do you think that's the way geopolitics will be practiced from now on? You know, regional actors having a free hand and doing whatever they want to do? Or do you think great powers will come back to the table and try to exert that influence in some shape or form?
Frankly, I think it's a great mistake. I understand Russia is, of course, preoccupied with Ukraine and expending, you know, its major resources, particularly military resources, in Ukraine. China has always avoided involvement in conflict away from its shores. But I think China and Russia ought to be more involved and are making a very dangerous mistake by not being more involved. But if you listen to any of the Security Council debates on the Middle East over the last few months, it's the Chinese and Russian delegates who speak the most sense. China and Russia should really be pooling their power and their authority, and China in particular should be exerting its muscle now, particularly its economic muscle, to force countries, particularly the United States, of which China holds trillions of the United States debt, to behave in a more responsible way, because otherwise there really is a risk that this could go rapidly out of hand and possibly into nuclear war. So I would love to see China and Russia be more assertive and impose some authority on the situation.
Well, Mr. Murray, I guess we will have to wait and see what the next year will bring in terms of the great power involvement and their geopolitical responsibilities. But for now, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for sharing your analysis.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.